Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, we'll hear from two more winners of the 2012 Dayton Literary Peace Prize. And I'll talk with Dr. Kent Youngman with the Greene County Mental Health Recovery Board about important issues taking place in their service area. Up first, when DHL left Wilmington several years ago, thousands of jobs were lost, crippling the local economy. The town and surrounding areas have been rebuilding ever since. One way they've been working on that is through green initiatives. Now, a group there, Energize Clinton County, has partnered with the University of Dayton to create a fun way to help residents save money. It's a computer game where users can go through their home room by room to figure out how to save more energy. Emily McCord spoke with Kevin Hallinan, the professor at the University of Dayton who helped Energize Clinton County develop Dropoly. She began by asking him how the game got its name.
A hummingbird is a motto, and so there's an African story or myth where there's a fire emerging. There's a fire, and all the animals are running away from the fire, and a hummingbird says, "No, I'm going to pick a drop of water and put it on the fire." And eventually, other animals realize all it takes is a lot of other animals adding drops to the fire to put the fire out. So that's what this is about. It's polydrops. It's more than one drop. It's more than one person. It's more than one community contributing toward reduction of energy, which in the end means improvement of the climate. I would add too, it also means dropping energy, dropping costs, dropping greenhouse gases. So it's actually a pretty complicated answer.
Well, and then when you look at the software, the hummingbird makes an appearance there. It's part of the very colorful kind of scene that you have there with the house and the people and being able to see just sort of where you can put your energy savings and input that information into that as well.
Yeah.
I wonder how much money are we talking about? How much money can you save when you're talking about saving energy costs?
A typical home. Let's say the average square footage in this part of the country is about, let's say, 2,000 square feet. So energy costs, on average, are about $3,000 a year. A typical resident can save probably about 40% of that just simply through actions, through behavior changes. And we want people to understand that because there's low-hanging fruit, lower thermostat settings in the winter, higher in the summer, shorter showers, turning the lights off when not in rooms. There's so much waste that we can do something about. We want to let people know what their decisions, even unconscious decisions, are making through this site.
I'm also joined in the studio with Mark Rembert. He's the co-director of Energize Clinton County. Mark, welcome.
Thank you.
I'm curious. You're talking about, maybe a couple dollars here and there adding up into what could be more energy savings in a home. How does that translate in any sort of meaningful way to a community's economy?
Well, I think if you sort of take that math of $3,000 a year in energy costs for the average home, and say even we'll just take 30% drop, so that's $1,000 savings a year times 1,000 homes, then you're looking at $1 million in savings a year. So I mean, $1 million in savings for a community of our size is significant. We'd love for that money to be spent at our local businesses, to be donated to our nonprofits, our churches. There's so many ways in which that money, especially in our community and given our economic situation, we need that money to be invested. We need that money to be put to work to rebuild our community. So, there are 10,000 homes in our county, and we're a small county, and so you start taking 1,000 homes at a time, that's $1 million that's kept in. And, that becomes a significant impact. And these are significant impacts that don't take a lot of work. I mean, it's really asking people to just, if anything, raise their awareness and consciousness for how they're using energy in their home. There's nothing like this out there. You know, it's been so amazing for us to be able to work with Kevin and the Droply team, because it really is, I mean, it's so special. It is at the cutting edge of an industry which still has so much more potential to change our communities, to change our homes, to change the country. And this, you know, Droply is really at that cutting edge.
This is really a big benefit. An energy audit conducted by a professional auditor will cost anywhere from $200 to $450 for a house. The goal here is for this to be free to individuals.
But one more, you know, of course, like the user goes and sees like the website and it looks awesome. It's like a beautiful layout. But the real innovation is the stuff behind the scenes. And I think, you know, that is the result of many, many years of research by people like Kevin at the University of Dayton that have done incredible work in our backyard. I think sometimes often, again, sort of behind the scenes, but really some of the most interesting, innovative work on energy efficiency has been going on at the University of Dayton for many, many years, and that's now the backbone of something like this. So I think the user doesn't necessarily see that, but that's the secret sauce in the system.
I've been speaking with Kevin Hallinan. He's a professor at University of Dayton, at the University of Dayton, and Mark Rembert, co-director of Energize Clinton County. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Emily.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us on this Sunday morning. Joining me in studio today, Kent Youngman is the CEO of the Greene County Mental Health and Recovery Board. We're going to talk about some issues in Greene County with mental health and substance abuse. Kent, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jerry. Appreciate being here.
So in our initial contact, you stated that you and your staff are constantly amazed by the lack of awareness that folks have about mental health and addiction issues. Explain.
Yes, we are. There are a lot of misconceptions in terms of mental health and addiction issues. One of those being that folks don't recover from those kinds of things, and that the data just really doesn't support that with the right kind of treatment and the right kind of involvement. That also involves supportive families and community involvement. People can get better, and they do improve. If a person has a mental illness, sometimes those are episodic. Sometimes they last for a period of time, and they recover, and then they really don't need much more after that. At other times, it's something that does require a lifetime of attention, but folks can live very healthy, productive lives in the community. People that deal with addictions, it's the same sort of thing, but those folks have to be constantly vigilant and constantly aware of the fact that there may be triggers or there may be things in their environment that could cause them to relapse, and they have to work against that. So community support, personal commitment, and family involvement is very important.
So let's talk about what's actually taking place in Greene County. Can you give us a picture of some of the top mental health issues and addiction issues that people are facing?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I'd like to help clarify a little bit, though. We do cover actually three counties. We're in Greene County and in Clark County and in Madison County. The board has responsibility for that. So if you kind of put up your left hand and say, this is Dayton, and your right hand and say, this is Columbus, we're pretty much everything in between.
Okay.
So it's a real mix of rural, suburban, and urban areas within those three counties. A lot of the different things that we're seeing in terms of the drug and alcohol field, one of the things that has come up very strongly in the last couple of years is heroin and opiate addictions. That's not unique to this area. That's really across the state and across the country. But what we're seeing is a lot of times folks have a legitimate injury, something happens, they have a back injury, something like that, and they begin to take painkillers for that. For whatever reason, they become addicted to that, and then it becomes a situation that really is very unhealthy for them. Some folks move from that to heroin. Heroin and opiate painkillers are very similar chemically, and so we're seeing a real increase in use of heroin within our communities. And we are beginning to see heroin as an entry drug for some youth, which is a very frightening trend. So in that case, it's not that they've started with something else. Sometimes they start directly with that. It's readily available, and it's relatively inexpensive.
And is that why you attribute the increase in that statistics or the use of heroin?
Yes, I think it is. It's not only the fact that it's pretty available and it's pretty inexpensive, it's very powerful, and there are also similar kinds of things that folks may get out of their medicine chest. If someone, you know, has an injury, they get a painkiller. We have prescriptions that are left over. That frequently happens. You know, someone gets a 10-day supply, they only need 3 days, and then it goes in the medicine chest. And what we know statistically is 70 to 80% of the prescription opiates that are misused come from a family member or a friend's medicine cabinet. And then that many times leads into other kinds of substances.
There has been statewide a push for programs dealing with prescription medicine, the state asking for folks to turn those medicines in, and Greene County, I believe, is participating in
yes,
that program.
Yes, they are. We have, and we work with the sheriff's departments and local police to do drug takebacks. There's also a move to try to locate drop-off boxes, and Greene County is working on that, trying to develop. There are some restrictions around that. It has to be in a place that's monitored by law enforcement, and they have to be disposed of properly. So it's not as easy as just, you know, taking it down to the corner and dropping it off somewhere. But that's a way that folks can get rid of them more readily. There are other kinds of things people can do. Mix them with used kitty litter or with coffee grounds. And then throw them away. What we don't want to do is put them in a place that other people can then get a hold of them and misuse them. So there are a number of ways that they can be disposed of properly.
What are some of the other issues facing your service area?
We, along with every other agency that receives public funding, is dealing with reduction in availability. We understand that because of reductions at the state level, the amount of funding that we have has been reduced. And as a result of that, we have reduced capacity. When we go back and look at 2009, which is when all of this began, to where we are right now, our ability to serve folks has been reduced by about 1,200 people a year, which is a big number. So what that means is that it takes longer for folks to get in. Counselors and clinicians have a bigger caseload, and some people just simply don't wait and they don't get served. It's tragic, but it's the reality that we're dealing with.
And so what are some of the overall numbers of the people that you're servicing in the three-county area?
In the three-county area, in 2009, direct support. Now, when I say direct support, those are folks that received public funding, about 15,000 in 2009. 2012, that dropped down to about 13,500 or so. There are some compounding factors. I mean, because we can support agencies, they can see other people that they might not be able to see if we didn't help support them. But directly, it's between 15 and 13,000 annually across our region.
I'm interested in hearing how factors affect a community as far as mental health issues, substance abuse, factors like the economy or the holiday season. Do you have data on that?
Yeah, one of the things that people frequently believe is that suicides go up during the holiday season. That statistically, that's not true. There are other months of the year. There doesn't really seem to be any particular month in which that is higher or lower. But things like stress, external stress, and certainly being unemployed or underemployed, those are stressful kinds of things. Those can help contribute to depression levels. And talking about suicide, we know that the two factors that are the most prominent with suicide are depression and substance abuse. So we know that those things are in place. And both of those are treatable, but unfortunately, many times people do not seek treatment for those. So those kinds of things are in place. Certainly community stress. And I mentioned suicide. To go from 1 year to another year is not a trend. 2 years doesn't make a trend. But we are seeing surprisingly high increases in suicide rates from 2011 to 2012 across all three of our counties. In 2011 in Greene County, there were 12 completed suicides, and in 2012, there were 17. In Clark County, it's 14 and 18. And in Madison County, there were 2 in 2011 and 6 in 2012. Those are troubling statistics. We have suicide prevention coalitions in place that work on raising awareness and doing trainings and those kinds of things. The same sorts of trends are also in place in Montgomery County, for example. They've had an increase of something around 40%. So we are seeing some of these things that are troubling.
I'm speaking with Kent Youngman, CEO of the Greene County Mental Health and Recovery Board. And Kent, for folks who find themselves in need or know of someone in need of mental health or addiction services, what's the best way to proceed?
Well, as I said earlier, since we're in three counties, there are three different contact points. In Greene County, the agency that can provide immediate crisis kinds of services is TCN Behavioral Health. Their number is area code 937-376-8700. In Clark County, it's Mental Health Services. They are the contact point. Their number is 937-399-9500. And in Madison County, it's Mental Health Services for Madison County. Their number is area code 740-852-6256. Those numbers are answered 24 hours a day. If it's after hours, they may direct you to an emergency room and someone may meet you there, but that would be the contact point if a person is in crisis or is seeking information about mental health or drug and alcohol services in a local community.
Kent Youngman with Greene County Mental Health and Recovery Board, thanks so much for speaking with us this
morning.
Thank
you. We really appreciate the opportunity.
In our conversation, Dr. Youngman also noted that in Ohio and across the country, the availability of mental health and addiction services has severely eroded over the past two decades. Community-based services aren't adequate to meet an ever-expanding need. The ability to provide psychiatric hospitalization is limited at best, and doing more for less only goes so far. Eventually, it becomes doing less for less. When services are scarce, fewer people get the help they need, and more mental illness is left untreated. Thanks for joining us. This is WISO Weekend on WYSO.
My name is Specialist Parker Haley. I want to give a warm shout out to my family and friends back in Wilmington, Ohio, here from Heidelberg, Germany. Happy holidays.
Hi, I'm Nicole Rush here in Kunsan, Korea. I'd like to say Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays to my family back in Dayton, Ohio. Hi, Ricky. Hi, Tonio. Hi, Mom and Dad and all my friends and family out there. Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays.
Hi, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Teresa Berninger from Bagram, Afghanistan, with the Joint Combat Casualty Research Team. I'd like to wish happy holidays to my family in Dayton, Ohio, and to my kids, Adler, Alina, and Avriel, and husband Wes in Schofield Barracks, Hawaii. Happy holidays.
This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. This week, we continue our series of speeches from the 2012 Dayton Literary Peace Prize with winners from the nonfiction and fiction categories. First, we'll hear from Adam Hochschild, the nonfiction winner. His book, To End All Wars, chronicles World War I and its effect on soldiers, generals, and pacifists on the home front.
As a reporter, I've encountered a certain amount of conflict and war directly, but I prefer writing about history because sometimes I think that when we look at events far back in the past, or not so far back in the past, but removed from the time that we're living in right now, we can see things a little bit more clearly. And I have long been fascinated by the First World War, because it seems to me in so many ways such a monument to so many dimensions of human folly. The nations of Europe had all been getting along with each other rather well, and then they fell into unprecedented destruction through an odd chain of events that began in late June 1914 with the assassination of the Austrian Archduke at Sarajevo. Even 4 weeks later, the end of July 1914, the continent was still at peace. But less than a month later, the war that broke out was so immensely destructive of human life that in August of that year, in a single country, France, more than 23,000 French soldiers were killed in one single day of fighting. And death tolls like that recurred again and again and again throughout the war until by the time it ended, there were more than 9 million soldiers dead and probably, though we'll never know the exact figure, an even larger number of civilians. Something I find haunting about this war when we look back on it, when, as I say, we can see it a little more clearly, is that it was clearly based on a number of illusions. Two of them seem paramount to me. One was that on both sides, everybody thought the war would be won quickly and easily. The second illusion was that winning the war would resolve certain crucial questions, the main one being who was going to be boss in Europe. Almost nobody anticipated the long time that the war would last, nearly 4.5 years, the vast number of deaths, the way this war remade the world in every conceivable way for the worse, and of course the way it laid the groundwork for the rise of Hitler and the coming of a second, even more deadly and even more destructive world war. In closing, I would say this. Historians like to write about things not just because they're inherently interesting or important, but because sometimes there are echoes in these events for today. And I would suggest that those illusions about the First World War that I just mentioned are still very much with us today. The illusion that when we start a war, it's going to be over with quickly and easily. You remember the image of President Bush landing on that aircraft carrier in 2003 in front of that big banner that said, "Mission accomplished." A lot of us are still not sure what the mission was or whether it's been accomplished. And the second illusion is that jumping into war will solve a problem rather than create additional problems and complications that nobody can quite imagine. I think those illusions lay behind the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, just as they lay behind the war of 1914-1918. And they also lie behind the war that some people would like to start with Iran. So history has lessons for us, and we need to listen hard to hear them. One of those lessons was put very succinctly into words by a great military man, General Omar Bradley, who once said, "We know more about war than we know about peace." Thank you.
Adam Hochschild, winner of the 2012 Dayton Literary Peace Prize in nonfiction for his book, To End All Wars. The winning book in the fiction category also takes place during World War I. The Sojourn is based in part on stories that the author, Andrew Krivak's grandmother and mother, told him about life in the old country.
When I was a boy, I had a dog named Troy. He was a black lab and a collie mix. His arrival at our house in Dallas, Pennsylvania, which is just about 8 miles west of Wilkes-Barre, during a December snowstorm when I was 2, is one of my first memories. He was supposed to have been named Thor, but the story goes that I couldn't get my mouth around the TH. So my older brothers agreed to change his name. And Troy, true to the myth, grew to be a fighter, fast and sleek and muscular, against every attempt my father made to tie him up, to rein him in, to break his spirit and teach him to obey, which in the end proved to be his undoing. Dogs, that is, not my father's. Discipline was my father's craft, and he taught me well. But Troy, I realized years later when I began to read fiction in college, Troy was like the dog named Lion in Faulkner's The Bear, fearless, resilient, loyal, determined to overpower, and all because he could not be taught to obey. He'd get scared, but he was never afraid. I mentioned Troy because it was past this dog, past his house, his dog house that we kept in our backyard. Troy on the leash that stretched to its bitter end so that he could push his cold, wet nose into my hand. That I walked on my way from the house in which I grew up to my grandmother's house, my mother's mother's house, who had been born in America but emigrated to Austria-Hungary before the Great War. There was a path worn past Troy, through a stretch of woods, up the next street, and into my grandmother's kitchen that seemed merely an extension in my mind of my mother's own kitchen. And it was there, at that table, next to a wood stove, where I sat with my younger brother and listened to the stories of a hard life in a hard land, the hunger, the survival, the meanness, the war, always told with a distant sadness on her face. And yet in the rising and falling tones of the beautiful Slovak she spoke, most of which my mother had to translate for us, so that she too moved to the sadness of her own mother. I didn't consider the origin or the purpose of those stories then. They were exotic on one level, a kind of Slovak Arabian Nights, and understandable on another, as my brother and I came to know firsthand what it meant to stand up for each other in a place where fighting came with the territory. But regardless, I listened and let those stories find a way in because I loved and I trusted the teller. But when I moved from the world of stories told to books that I could pick up and read on my own, I understood what my grandmother was doing for herself in the constant telling and retelling of those stories, trying to come to peace with the fact that she had survived. And all of those tellings were in some way a kind of unburdening and an embrace of belief. She had disobeyed what fate had fallen to others. She had unleashed herself from a world that sought to break her spirit. She had been given something, a life, another soul who loved her, a chance to love children, a freedom in a land to which she had been born, and yet all her adult life lived almost as a stranger. And she told me those stories not to entertain her wide-eyed grandsons, but to remind herself of what she had been given, and perhaps to test daily her own personal question, a question we all ask at some point. Is it enough? Is it worthy what I have made? And when we walked back home from my grandmother's house on those days, past Troy the dog, who would bound up to us on his leash when he saw us coming out of the woods on that path and push his nose again into my hand, I wanted to set him loose, to unclip the nylon rope from his collar and let him run free. Maybe, I thought, maybe this time he'd see. He would see and he would stay, not give up so much as lay down that need in him to fight. And I tell you, there were dogs in our neighborhood who bore his scars, but he never bit another person and became docile around children. But he would find the porch, I imagined, and sit there like some benign lord who no longer had anything to prove, waiting, unfettered, unbound, but it wasn't to be. He got away on his own one day, and before any one of us could get to him, he was put down. This novel that I've written, The Sojourn, to which you've given this powerfully humbling prize, for which I'm so grateful, began as I listened to those stories of life in a strange land, lived by a man, my grandfather, whom I never knew, and a woman whose survival meant the possibility of my own. And as a result, I wondered to myself if I might unleash an imaginative world wherein I would find nothing impossible or bound. In another time, in another place, I could tell you where and how each of those stories that make up the fictional life of Joseph Vinich bend back into something I heard or imagined around that stove in Dallas, Pennsylvania, when I was a boy with a dog so aptly named Troy. But tonight it's enough to say that somehow those voices transformed from words of war and hardship there at the table, spread out like bread and wine, into a desire, in this boy at least, to hear them and transform them into words that bend towards peace. And so I want to dedicate this award to those who shaped me, to John and Elizabeth, who passed away a long, long time ago, and to my father, Thomas, who gave me discipline and freedom in the end, and my mother, Irene, she to whom I dedicated the sojourn and whose name means peace, passed away this May, and I miss talking to her. They've all done their work. They've all found their peace. What remains is for us to keep telling of it as well as to keep praying for it, to keep insisting upon it as well as to keep hoping for it, and to keep listening so that we'll know when to act, whether it's out in the world, Beirut, Iraq, Louisiana, or at work on a sentence, alone in a room with words. So to each and every one of you, please accept my deepest gratitude for this prize and all of the kind words you've said to me about this story that I've fashioned out of stories. And may God bless the labor of your hands. Thank you.
Andrew Krivak, his book, The Sojourn, won the 2012 Dayton Literary Peace Prize in the fiction category. On New Year's Day, WISO will bring you a special presentation of speeches from the writers honored this year. That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WISO. Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Merry Christmas and happy holidays. Coming up next on WISO, The Book Club.